Hi, everybody. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration. And I want to welcome you to today's live ROI webinar, How to Use Social Data to Increase Revenues, sponsored by Bizarre Voice. Did you know that social data can help retailers increase operating margins by 60% and reduce manufacturing profit development and assembly costs by 50%? Well, it's true. And although social data continues to surface at an alarming rate, companies are still having a hard time when it comes to gleaning customer insights from social data and using it to drive real business results. Today, we have a lively interactive webinar planned with Joe Pulizzi, who's the founder of the Content Marketing Institute and the leading evangelist for content marketing in the B2B space, and Scott Koester, Senior Manager of Intelligence Products at Bizarre Voice, to learn the following: best practices around social sharing and content marketing, how to use and share social data to build improved products, how to drive consumer insights from social data, and how to create new and improved products through customer recommendations. Before we get started, however, let me point out a few quick tips about how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing questions at the end of the hour. You can also send them in anytime, however. Also, please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. Well, let's get started. So take it away, Joe.
Melissa, thanks so much. Really appreciate being on the webinar today. So for everyone that's not familiar with myself or for content marketing, my job on today's webinar is to really talk about the idea of content marketing, what it is, and then I'm going to hand it off to Scott, and Scott's really going to talk about what happens when you create content that creates some kind of an action and what you can do with that kind of data. So I'm glad Scott's on board to really give the data intelligence part of this conversation. But I'm going to try to talk a little bit about content marketing. It's something I'm very passionate about, and it's something that I do all day long, and I've been doing for more than a dozen years now. So I'm going to take it away. We're talking about social data here, and I'm going to take you all the way back to 1837. Whenever I talk about content marketing, I love talking about John Deere. John Deere is often recognized as one of the first examples of content marketing. And if you're not familiar with content marketing as a term, I'll talk about it in a second. But let me tell you the story about John Deere. So John Deere, back in 1837, small business owner, had an innovation. And the innovation was, at the time, plows actually would go through the dirt, and they were iron plows, but in a lot of cases, the dirt would get stuck to the plow, and it was really a hampering on the efficiency of a farmer. And John Deere had a creation innovation and said, well, what if we put steel on the tip of that plow, and it actually steel went through the dirt and the dirt did not stick. And it was a really amazing innovation for the time, but John's a small business owner, didn't really know how to get, you know, didn't have a lot of advertising dollars at the time, didn't know really what to do to get more people's attention. And said, okay, here's what we're going to do. So John Deere actually started to put classes together and put structured classes together on how businesses could be more successful or how farmers could be more successful in their business as farmers and business owners. And started to put these very successful classes together. John Deere started to get a reputation for an amazing teacher. And at the end of these classes, the farmers that were in those classes would say, you know, John, do you sell anything? He said, oh, yes, by the way, I have this innovation called a steel plow, and went through it, and the rest is history. And that's how he got started, by actually telling stories, teaching classes, positioning himself as an expert, and basically sharing amazing content. So take that the next step further, and we're going to talk about the Furrow magazine. So, of course, I know you're probably like, wow, this is about social data, and we're talking about 1837 and then into print magazines. But John Deere launched a print magazine in the late 1900s on the left side, late 1800s, on the left side from 1931. It's actually the oldest image I could find of the Furrow magazine. And the one on the right is the most recent issue of the Furrow magazine from John Deere. But the same thing happened. A lot of technology changes were going on in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and John Deere was like, how can we get out information to make farmers more successful and help and create content that ultimately would be shared, that ultimately could build a relationship with our customers? And they actually became, the Furrow magazine became the largest, most people don't realize this, it's the largest circulated farming magazine in the world. And it's done not by a media company, but by John Deere. 1.5 million circulation, 14 languages, 40 countries, and again, number one circulated. So the idea, I really want to talk about this in the frame of, a lot of people think content marketing is new and it's all online, but it's been going on for a long, long time. We've been telling stories. It's just today we have processes and technology that we can do more with the data from those stories. And just, you know, for an example, if you go to, you know, why do people end up following John Deere, talking about them? I mean, look at the history of John Deere as a storytelling organization. You've got 1.5 million people liking them on Facebook. This is what happens when you can tell a good, compelling story on a consistent basis. People want to talk about you, they want to follow you, and they want to do something with the content that you're giving them. So when I talk about content marketing, it's the idea that you own your own media channels. You don't necessarily rent those like you normally would with advertising. So basically, if you are a content marketer, which you all are, because 90% of all brands create their own content to attract and retain customers, you're trying to create valuable, relevant, compelling content on a consistent basis to do something, right? To change or enhance a behavior. And that's why you're here today, because you're trying to figure out how you can create more content to get more of the data that you can move your business in the right direction. I'm going to move to the side a second because I think this is really important, and most people don't realize this when it comes to content creation, especially online today. But if you look at the difference between what a media company does when they create their content and what you do as a marketer, if you are a marketer, so pick your side. You're either, you know, a media company or a marketer, one side or the other. And there's actually only one difference between how content is created on one side versus the other. Most people think, oh, publishers, media companies, the content we create is so much different. It's actually not. And here's the difference. And if I was in class right now, I would be asking you, there's no wrong answers, but what would you say? And the answer is how the money comes in. And it's very important that you understand this, because with all the technology barriers to entry for publishing gone, there really are opportunities to create amazing content, but there's also challenges as well. But let me go through this a little bit. If you are a media company and you are creating content, 99% of the business models in media, the money comes in two different ways. One is that content is sponsored in some way, advertising. So you might buy an advertisement in somebody's magazine or display ad on somebody's page. That's one way. The second way is you're going to buy their content, a magazine subscription, online subscription, paid content, paid ebook, book, whatever the case is. That's that business model. The business model of creating content, as when we're talking about content marketing, is you create content in order to sell more products and services. In every other case, almost everything else is the same. So I want you to start thinking about that, and I think that we really have to, as marketers, be more responsible with how we create content, because there is really no difference with how that content gets out there and moves forward. But the one thing that really is amazing about we follow media, I mean, look at this as Forbes, and look at the number of followers they have versus the number that they're following. People want to follow companies that tell amazing stories. And so what we do full time at the Content Marketing Institute is to teach brands how to do this. I mean, that's how to become amazing storytellers. And I really think that that's where you can really get some amazing data and insight. And of course, Scott's going to get into that in a second. But I want you to think about this. If your goals are search engine optimization, being found in Google, online lead generation, social media, you know, do you have anything of interest at all to say in social media, and how can you make that work for your business? In the middle of that is content marketing. In the middle of that is, what are your stories? What makes you interesting? What are the pain points of your customers, and how are you going to solve those pain points through amazing content? And then when you get that feedback, what do you do with it? So let me give you a couple of examples. So here's an example of trying, maybe a little bit more than an example of trying, but this very, very happy gentleman that you're looking at is Mr. Jonathan Mildenhall. Jonathan is the VP of Global Advertising for Coca-Cola, if you're not familiar with Jonathan. And what I think is interesting about what he's been able to do at Coca-Cola, I don't know if you're all familiar with this small little movie called Jerry Maguire. It was out a few years ago by this relatively unknown actor called Tom Cruise. But Jerry Maguire, Jonathan did something of what I call the Jerry Maguire moment. So if you remember the beginning of the Jerry Maguire movie, when, you know, Tom Cruise wakes up, he's in a sweat, and he realizes and has this epiphany that their firm needs to have less clients, and he creates that blue folder, that blue book, and he passes it out to everybody, and that ultimately gets him fired. Well, Jonathan had the same type of Jerry Maguire moment, except he did not get fired. He actually got a promotion, and he did because of this. And this is Coca-Cola's Content 2020. And this is their mission statement for, and their content strategy, actually, for how they're going to ultimately go to market. Let me go into a little bit of detail, because if you have not seen, if you are a marketer or PR professional, or a publisher for that matter, and you've not seen these two videos that go with Coca-Cola's Content 2020, you need to do this. There's two videos, there's 7 minutes and 10 minutes. And it basically goes through Coca-Cola strategy saying, look, we know that we spend more money on traditional marketing than pretty much anybody in the world. And we've been focusing on our creative excellence. And what Jonathan says in this video series is if we're going to make our big goal, and Coca-Cola's big goal by 2020 is to double their sales. So that's a lot of extra sugary drink, right? And how are they going to do that? Jonathan says they're going to do this by telling amazing stories. He says by moving from creative excellence to content excellence, and they call it liquid storytelling, so kind of a play on storytelling from Coca-Cola's standpoint. So this was their strategy, a 17-minute, two-video series that was their strategy, and here is the first representation of that strategy. This just came out a couple weeks ago. It was covered in the Journal. It was covered in the Times. It got a lot of press, and it's Coca-Cola Journey. It's basically their first adaptation of Coca-Cola's Content 2020 strategy. So in Coca-Cola Journey, they're telling all kinds of stories, interesting stories that are that they feel that Coca-Cola customers and prospects would be interested in. Some of it's about Coca-Cola, some of it's not, but it all revolves around what Coca-Cola stands for, around happiness, and you can kind of go into the site and get some more detail. They have 4 full-time people and 40 freelancers on this, making this site go. And if you look at the site, this is a media site. It just happens to be backed by Coca-Cola. So there's one example that I see of content marketing trying. Let me give you an example of who I see. When somebody asks me, they say, Joe, who's the leader in content marketing? Who does it the best from an owned media standpoint? And it's this company. It's another sugary drink, one that I actually like with vodka, believe it or not, Red Bull Media House. And Red Bull Media House is an amazing internal content factory into Red Bull. So if you're not familiar with it, let me just give you some of the highlights about what they do at Red Bull Media House. So they have Red Bull Content Pool. If you're familiar with the Space Jump guy that just happened a month or so ago, basically they took a lot of that content, a lot of the video, the pictures, the textual content, and they sell that to other media companies. This is a profit center for Red Bull. Sounds like a media company, right? That's exactly right. Red Bull is a media company that just happens to sell energy drinks, believe it or not. They also have a record label. Most people are not familiar with Red Bull Records. That's becoming actually fairly popular in the indie community. They have the Red Bulletin, which is one of the best examples of a digital magazine out there. So if you're looking for an amazing example of a digital magazine, I would check out the Red Bulletin. They also produce the Red Bulletin in print in multiple countries. And, you know, here's just a look and overseas. So you can see here's all the brands that are going along with, you know, kind of Red Bull Media. They have a radio station, television station, and whatnot. And I think this is the future of where you're headed as brand, where we're headed as brands now, because in order to get attention, we've got to create amazing, compelling content, but we have to have a process around it, and we have to make sure that when we get all the data from that content online, that we're doing something with it. Throw in a little bit of research behind this. This is our annual content marketing benchmark study. These are the B2C recently we've done B2B and B2C this year, so if you want to download the full research package, just go to contentmarketinginstitute.com/research, and you can download the full research. But this sort of gives you the idea that, yes, we are all publishers now. Look at these are all the channels that you're creating content for on a consistent basis. So I like to show this stat so you really say, yeah, we really are all, yes, you are all publishers, and it also means we have to take a renewed responsibility in doing something not only with the process but the data that we get. A couple of examples that I like to show, homemadesimple.com, created in 2003 from Procter & Gamble. They're really targeting moms on the go that have a job and, of course, have the house to take care of with the father, but they really target women that are in this place, and they have more than 10 million people actually signed up to get regular email updates from Procter & Gamble. How'd you like that? To have people raise their hand and say, yes, Procter & Gamble, I'd love to get sales information from you. So that is one example of what we're seeing, creating content that starts kind of the social interaction and the word of mouth online. I have to be honest with you, I don't spend a lot of time on this site. I have two boys, 9 and 11, and some of these the portions of this site scare me a little bit, actually. But this is beinggirl.com. And beinggirl.com, their mission is to help adolescent teen girls out with their challenges that they have, that they're dealing with. But this is the type of content platform that we're seeing created that's sort of spurring the interaction online. From a B2B standpoint, this is American Express Open Forum. They really work heavily with the influencer community, so it's a great example of combining social media and content. They believe it or not, this is a media site, this is a publishing site, and they get more people to sign up for open cards from this site than anything else that they do, and they've been publishing this site, I believe, since 2008. So we're really starting to see this trend of content platforms, and kind of the process is set up, and then this is my last slide, and then I'm going to pass it over to Scott. When you look at the content marketing team and you look at the roles, and then I think there's a really good segue into what Scott's going to talk about here. These aren't job titles. You don't have to go out and hire a chief content officer, but you have to think about what these roles are. So chief content officer, you have somebody that's running the content strategy. Then you have a managing editor who's kind of half most important person in the marketing department, I believe, half project manager, half storyteller. You have the content producers. They make that content look sexy in digital for you and through social media. And you have chief listening officers. I'll get back to those in a second. And then you have the content creators. Could be all of these people, could be none of these people, could be employees, customers, and whatnot. But I think where the good handoff is, and we're talking about creating best-of-breed content, is in this chief listening officer role. So there's a couple things. So when the chief listening officer, that could be a social media manager. It could be an actual chief listening officer, like Kodak has actually hired a position called a chief listening officer. They have to make sure that when you send this content out there, there's hopefully, if you're doing it right, there is a response. There is feedback. That feedback that comes in, that could go back to the chief content officer to get them to change the content strategy, or it could be sent to, okay, I've got this, and this needs to go to customer service, this needs to go to product marketing, whatever. What we're seeing the best of breed companies do, and this is what Scott's going to talk about, is when you send out content out there, whether it's user-generated content or whether it's user-generated content or from anything else, what you're seeing is this type of data that's coming in, you need to do something with that data. It needs to be actual data that you can do something with. So you've got to make sure from this standpoint that something happens here. And so what I'm going to do right now is for Scott to go on to the next. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, excellent. I thought you lost me for a second. I got a couple notices, but I'm glad I came back. So, Scott, I'm glad you're here, because you've been doing, you know, you've been focusing on in charge of intelligence at Bizarre Voice for quite a while. This is your expertise area, so hopefully I've set everything up with from, you know, how you can create content, some good examples of content, and then maybe you can talk about how they can look at their own content and user-generated content and do something with the data that they're getting from this.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great segue and a great setup. Thanks a bunch, Joe, for doing that portion on the front end. So again, like the focus of what we're going to talk about here is how to increase revenue by putting the customer voice at the center of your business. And if we really think about it, it even goes beyond increasing revenue. It really goes to driving that bottom line. And when you think about it, how could you help drive that bottom line? Well, if you have a product or a service that people might be able to return, if you identify reasons that people might return those products or services, you could reduce that. So by reducing returns, that's going to be able to hit and impact your bottom line as well. As far as increasing revenue, if people are on your website and they see that other customers like whatever product or service you might be selling, that's going to drive higher conversion. And whether that conversion event is someone adding it to the cart and go ahead and converting, or if that conversion event is clicking on a button that creates a lead for another part of your business, those are all increased conversion events. And the customers, again, listening to them, harnessing their voice, can help identify how to drive those events higher. And if you think about it from a long-term perspective, listening to those customers is going to drive higher CSAT and retention. And we've done a number of studies lately that show when customers interact with your products or services, 25% of their long-term CSAT, as measured in NPS score, is driven by the actual products that you either sell or create for those customers. So from a long-term perspective and the ability to retain those customers long-term, using that voice of the customer can be very, very helpful. So moving on, you know, two things, just a quick understanding of Bizarre Voice. There's kind of two things we do. Number one is we spark conversations, get customers to interact with brands or retailers or service providers. And then the secondary thing is unlock the social insights that come from those conversations. And a lot of times we flip those things on their head, and a lot of times companies want to work with companies like ourselves as they want to get those social insights. And then to do so, they have to spark those conversations. So the insights is a lot of times the big value driver for folks to go and do a social program. And so when we think about sparking those conversations on your own digital properties, there's a couple of different ways that happens most likely. Number one, the one that people are most familiar with is all about customer reviews, and that's probably what Bizarre Voice is most well known for, but it goes much beyond that. Another thing could be all about conversations, whether people have questions about a product or a service, or they want to interact with other like-minded people like them to get input on what might be most applicable to them. Those are sort of the conversations that are happening on websites as well. And if you think about where those conversations are going, the concept of real-time and different channels to communicate with people, whether that's SMS, email, having those conversations happen right on the website, all those are different interaction points that are really important to create a really healthy conversation with those customers. And then the last kind of general category we think about is, and this is all stuff that's happening today, are things that are all driving about the experience with maybe a brand or a service. So less about a product, but more about the experience. And those can be things that range from, you know, how to create a great cooking recipe and which items to add to create the optimal recipe for a particular brand, to what's your experience been with a sporting goods apparel manufacturer. So those kind of really range, and they can be really generic. One thing to think about in the future, another area we think that's going to be growing in importance is the concept of really doing some real-time interaction on websites. So if a brand wants to interact with consumers on a retail website, the ability to actually start interacting in real time brands on retailers' websites, so trying to connect this whole ecosystem together in a real seamless way that makes sense both for consumers, for brands, for retailers, and anyone else that sells consumer goods and services. And, you know, whenever we talk to customers, you know, again, our tagline, this is kind of the slide we usually enter the conversation with, it kind of is a three-step conversation. Number one, we all know that putting the customer at the center of your business is absolutely paramount to be successful. Companies that do so will be extremely successful, have a higher stock price, higher valuation, and just be monumentally more successful. Companies that don't won't be around in 5 to 10 years. So that's the first thing, put the customer at the center of your business. Number two is a lot of companies, they don't realize it, but you're already sitting on a wealth of this customer data. You know, whether that's reviews, questions that people are asking about your products, whether that's a forum that you might have as part of your website, you've already got a wealth of this customer data. So the third thing, and the real focus of the area of work that I'm involved with, is how do we unlock that data? And the key to unlocking that data is a few things. Number one, it needs to be actionable. No one wants to know something for the sake of just knowing it, or they might once or twice, but to have that continued engagement to act on this data, it needs to be actionable rather than just as an FYI or kind of an understanding of what your customers are thinking. Number two, the information needs to come to you in a timely manner. So you don't want to be constantly monitoring all those conversations that are going on your website or other digital properties. you want to be notified that, hey, something's changed. It's time to take action on something. And making those conversations triggered is the way to go do that to make sure your time is most valuably used. And then the third and probably last and most important thing is you need to understand who within your organization is accountable for taking action on this. We do see companies where they have that chief listening officer or that social media listening group, but what we try to do, and I'll talk about this more in subsequent slides, is try to figure out who in the organization should take action and try to funnel that information directly to the person that can take action, and that can be very helpful, as well as trying to drive what is the ROI of taking this action. If you understand what that ROI is, the conversation with your CFO and CMO about why you want to invest in a social program and what you're going to go do with that, it becomes a lot easier conversation to get that investment, get that headcount, whatever it needs to create a successful program. Tying that back to ROI is absolutely paramount to getting that organizational buy-in. And so we think about how to make all this actionable. One of the main things you can do is link that social content directly to a product, a service, particular category of product, and people. And so when you create that link directly, it just makes it a lot more actionable. And an example I always tell people is if you are the person at Express in charge of women's sweaters and in the broader social web, let's say you see something on Facebook or Twitter or blog or forum that says, hey, the material of this sweater is really scratchy, this Express sweater I bought. The challenge that Express would have in that case is they don't know which of their 200 sweaters that the person is actually talking about. So that creates a lot of confusion, a lot of the noise that we see companies struggle with social data. But on the other hand, the way we actually go collect the data is usually tied to a specific product or a specific product line. And by doing that, when you ask people to comment or add content about a specific product, you know exactly who owns that product within your organization. It makes it a lot more actionable. And one of the things we're looking at doing, and we've already done some preliminary work on this, is tying that product catalog and going and looking in that broader social web to find pieces of information that are attributable back to a specific product or product line. And so that can make that broader social web a lot more actionable. And so when we do that, what happens is you can empower your company to create, stock, and market great products. And those products are for the right people. And that's key. The right people is a really important aspect. And that one thing you can find is that when people write content, a lot of times they'll give you very rich information about who they are. Are they male? Are they female? What's their age group? Do they have children or not? That information can be really invaluable to help market products more effectively. And so, for example, if you're a retailer, and we know there's a big trend in retail to shrink the size and the footprints of stores, if you understand that a certain zip code has a certain type of customer, whether it's highly female, higher income, well, if you understand which products resonate best with that target market, you can make sure you're stocking the right products in those stores to get the highest sell-through possible, given that limited shelf space that you have. So it's understanding who those right people are can be really important. And at the end of the day, when customers interact with a retailer or a brand or a person that provides a service, the biggest perception you have of a company is, do I like this product that I'm interacting with every day? And then the other facet of that is for what I paid for it. So that's the retailer stocking the right price, the right product at the right price, and the brand fulfilling that brand promise of what that product can do for a customer. So that's really important, and that's where we see the data that comes back through us in the form of customer reviews and other forms, there's really a lot of rich data about those products that we can help unlock for companies. And so to talk about just some real-world examples of how this comes to fruition, we want to talk about Cabela's. And the reason we want to talk about Cabela's is a couple of things. Number one, they're a well-known, pretty well-known retailer that specializes in outdoor equipment. But what's nice about them is they have brick-and-mortar stores. They also do online, so it's really pertinent to a lot of the folks that are on this call. Secondarily, they sell private label brands, so in that respect, they act like a brand. But they also sell nationally recognized brands, so they kind of span both segments there. And then their range of products are really, really broad. So they might sell women's sweaters, women's coats, but they also sell camping equipment, hunting equipment, all sorts of different product range. So the reason we want to select this to be most applicable of these stories to the broadest group on this webinar. And again, their goal when they were trying to really launch this social intelligence program was, again, unlock that insights from the social data to power their marketing, merchandising, and product innovation. We'll talk about some case studies and some examples of how they went and did that. And the first thing they wanted to do is take all this information and funnel it through the Bazaar Voice intelligence platform to route it to the right people. And that's the first step. I mean, if you have it all locked up in that central intelligence group or that customer insights team, that team is naturally a bottleneck, and you can't get the information fast enough to all the portions of the organization that could go take action on this content. So by funneling it through the product catalog and through our platform, we can actually route it to the right people in real time for them to take action. And so here's an example of a particular product that the product was fine, but the problem was the marketing copy on the website wasn't as optimized as it could be. So it was a one-star rated product. When they looked at all the customer content, you can see word clouds here about the content. One of the words that pops out would be adapters. And so when they click on the word adapter, they could see all the content about this product, and the complaint was not that the product wasn't good. The complaint was that it didn't include a specific adapter that the customers expected to be in that particular package. And so what was nice about this is the fix was really fast and easy for Cabela's. Number one, they didn't actually have to change the product. So a lot of times you want to change a product, it might take 3 or 6 months to funnel that through the whole supply chain. In this case, no product change was necessary. All they did was change the marketing copy on the website, that product description. And because of that, they're actually able to make that change in less than a day. So update that, and right after they did that, they're able to turn that one-star product into a 3.5-star product. And to take a one-star product that's got a number of reviews already and drive it to a 3.5-star product, that takes a lot of good 5-star reviews. And so you can see what the impact is of taking action on this content. Just a real simple action probably took them less than, 15 minutes to update that copy, and all of a sudden they've transformed this product that was not doing well and probably experienced a lot of returns in the store to something that was well-received by consumers. And if you think about, flashback 10 years from now or 10 years prior, if you got a high return rate for this product in the store, maybe you had a 15 or 20% return rate, a lot of open packages, what would you do? It would be very hard because customers probably aren't giving you feedback on why it wasn't working, and the person who's collecting that at the store, the returns clerk, probably isn't accurately categorizing why people are returning this. You might have no idea why this product has a high return rate. You might discontinue it, having to do all sorts of things with the inventory, but now in the age of social, it's really easy to understand what's going on with those products, even with a small sample set of content from consumers. So that's a real big transformation in the eyes of Cabela's of where they were 10 years ago versus where they are today. Another example is, they had a flashlight that had a quality issue. So this was actually a quality issue they had to go change. But in this case, that product is around, will be around for a couple of years. So making that change, and maybe it takes a few months to make that change, is a real good investment for Cabela's. And the other reason it's a good investment for Cabela's, and they really were appreciative of uncovering this, there was a switch on this light that wasn't working. It was jamming. It was really easy to see that in the reviews that they had on this product. They were able to take that back to their manufacturing team and change that. And the reason this is important for Cabela's and other retailers going forward is there's a big push for private label because private label goods are higher margin, and it also helps limit showrooming. But the key to private label is preserving the value of your brand, in this case Cabela's. So you want to make sure you sell the utmost and the highest quality products to consumers, so they trust that brand when they're thinking about buying another product in the future. And there's another example of another company that we work with that they had a pair of yoga pants that through reviews they found out that of the 26 quality measures, the manufacturer that supplied these yoga pants to them, they failed 24 of those 26 quality measures. And for them to go and test all of their products to uncover this would have been too onerous. But because the customer reviews, they identified this quickly, and they avoided restocking this product, which would have cost them in the millions of dollars. And so that's another example of how identifying quality issues can really save companies money over the long term. And then the last one, as we're on this flashlight example, another use case customers really get excited about is looking at competitors. So if you're thinking about creating a private label product, what are people saying about this Cabela's flashlight relative to a competitor like Maglite? A lot of times that content is sitting there in user content as well, and so understanding how you compare and contrast to a main competitor can be really helpful if you're trying to undercut that competitor in price a little bit but offer a similar quality of product. Now, moving on to an example that really speaks to like how different segments of the population view different products differently. So this is a pair of pants that these are the trail hiker pants at Cabela's. And these pants have been around for a number of years. They've gone through a lot of different iterations. And what happens with the most recent iteration is they actually changed and removed a particular pocket in the pants that the designers felt wasn't necessary anymore and maybe was not very good use of space on these pants. And so once they removed that pocket, what they found, and this was kind of interesting, is the younger demographic that had never bought a pair of these pants before didn't mind at all. But when you look at the older demographic, that this is maybe their third or fourth pair of this particular line of pants, there was a huge uproar from that particular group. And if you look at here, the word cloud, it was so obvious to Cabela's what happened. You see the words, you know, bring back original pocket. Those are the words based on word frequency that were displayed in these reviews. So it was really obvious for them what to go do. And what was really interesting is, again, just this older demographic, because they profile every one of their customers into four different segments or four different personas, this older persona were really adamant about bringing back the original pair, and the younger demographic was more indifferent. So if you think about how to move all this inventory of a product that maybe the older demographic didn't like, well, they've got segment-specific catalogs, so they can go push this product and discount this product to the younger demographic that still likes this product as is. So that's an interesting example of kind of segment-specific differences they were able to uncover through consumer content. And then let's talk about another one about, again, private label. So private label, we talked about how important that is. Again, with this example, you know, similar to the other ones, this product, what's interesting, was actually a highly rated product. So it was rated 4.3, which is right around the industry average within retail. So it's a decent product, no doubt about it. But what's interesting is even when you get a high-rated product and high reviews, maybe a four-star review says, you know, love the backpack, love the camo color, but... And a lot of times that but gives you that bit of information to make that product even better. And in this case, you know, people were saying that it wasn't water resistant and the shoulder straps were uncomfortable. They went and fixed that and they were able to drive that average rating up to a 4.8, which is just unbelievable when you think about how many five-star reviews it takes to raise something from a 4.3 to a 4.8. And really the impact for Cabela's is pretty obvious. If you have a product that has 20 or 30 reviews and it's rated 4.3, that's going to be a good selling product because customers see the number of people have bought this product because a lot of people have reviewed the product. But when you go and raise that to a 4.8 and maybe you have 50 or 60 reviews on the product, that product's going to be a runaway success. So just taking those little things and transforming the product and making it that much better can be very helpful. And another example kind of similar to this is I was shopping for a basketball goal for my children for Christmas, and it was a Fisher-Price. I looked on their website. Everybody loved the product, all five stars, but every one of those reviews, the second line of them, almost to a T, said, but the net disintegrated over time. So looking at those products that people love but making them even better is a great way for customers to be even more happy with their brand. And in the case of Fisher-Price, they could go improve that net, find out all the people that bought that directly from Fisher-Price.com, and send them a replacement net and also just kind of a way to reach out to those customers. It's definitely an opportunity because everyone is experiencing that same issue. And so kind of to wrap this up a little bit, you know, again, for Cabela's, this is a quote from the chief marketing and e-commerce officer. You know, Bizarre Voice Intelligence enables our suppliers but also enables Cabela's private label brands. It's an invaluable asset to our business, and they've just really been a great partner with this and really helped us kind of transform what our roadmap is for this particular product line that we continue to evolve over time. And the neat thing, again, about all this content, it's, you know, 24/7 digital focus group that doesn't have that lag. You know, if you look back 10 years ago when you look at a traditional survey, you know, you might ask people survey questions, and it might take 2 or 3 months to synthesize those responses and get that information back to a group. In this case, you can do this in real time. And you can even do it ahead of time in the fact that we've seen a number of clients start to launch products early and get some of that feedback before they do a broad launch, similar to how Amazon Vine program is working. And another way to create even a more focused digital focus group is identify those consumers that are really the bellwethers for a particular category. So if you have one consumer that's really consistently on target for how they view a product, and they're a precursor for what everyone else will think about the product, identify those people and really reach out to them proactively ahead of time to get their feedback early about a product. It can help you identify and change a product before you go and broadly market and sell products. And so those are just some of the examples of Cabela to try to bring this kind of into a real-world sense and kind of make it more real, some of the examples of what we're talking about today. And so for more information on how to unlock these social insights from customer data, feel free to contact us, info@bizarrevoice.com, or you can actually email me directly, scott.custer@bizarrevoice.com, and last name is spelled K-O-E-S-T-E-R. Be more than willing to discuss how this might apply to your business, because it's really interesting how, you know, different customers can take action on this, and everyone's business is different. That's why we're more than willing to consult with you and give you information on how it might apply most effectively to your business. And so with that, we'd love to open it up to questions and answers. If you haven't done so already, go ahead and submit one, and we'll start going through those.
Yep, great. Thank you so much, Scott and Joe. Great presentation. Lots of data and lots of information around social sharing, content marketing, et cetera. So we do, we're getting some good feedback on the presentation, so that's great. But we're going to start in with some questions, and we're still looking for more questions. But let's get started here. I'll start with some questions that relate to the example that Scott just mentioned where he was talking about Cabela's, because I feel like that's still fresh in people's minds. Could you talk a little bit more about the Cabela's example in terms of what Cabela's did with the inventory on hand, with the six switches? I mean, did they tell customers it was going to take months to correct? I mean, do you have any more details on that?
Yeah, I don't have information on that particular example, but I can tell you what a lot of customers do in that situation. I've worked with a golf retailer recently, and I'm good friends with one of the merchants there. And what he did a lot of times is, depending on the how big a deal that particular issue is, they'll either understand that early and go ahead and put it into their discount channel and discount it to get that product to move, or they'll do an RTV, return to vendor, and a lot of times they'll return, like in that case, I would imagine Cabela's would have returned that to the vendor. So that's one thing, return to the vendor, or get a discount from the manufacturer. And in the case for the golf apparel manufacturer or retailer, they actually had a belt that wasn't performing very well. They looked at it, identified the issue was that the buckle was actually falling off. They got a 50% off reduction in the price of their inventory from that manufacturer, a rebate, and they went and pushed that through their discount channel. So either return to vendor or discount the product more and get the manufacturer to pay for it.
Great. Okay, we have another question that I think could probably be answered by both of our speakers, however, with different perspectives. What if your company creates products that, like, aren't sexy or exciting? They're just – or maybe even personal and private? I mean, nobody's going to want to talk about checking accounts. So how do – you know, so for Scott, how do you spark the conversations about getting user-generated content going there? And then I guess on a broader level, Joe, you know, do you have any best practices around content marketing for the more sort of boring or commodity-type products? So, Kevin, maybe you can take it first.
Scott, you want to take it first, and then I'll go.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'll talk kind of as far as industries. So regardless if you think your industry is sexy or not, if you look at banking, if you look at like USAA, they're certainly leaders in this space, and you can listen to commercials, all sorts of different things where they're collecting content about checking accounts or savings accounts, stuff you'd think is very unsexy, but they collect a ton of content in those areas. So it really, you know, it goes across lots of industries. And then to give you another example, anybody think kitty litter sexy? I think the answer is no. Fresh Step Kitty Litter has collected over 10,000 pieces of content on kitty litter alone.
Wow.
So there's a lot of different ways and best practices on how to go incite those conversations and get people to contribute. But in the Fresh Step Kitty Litter, it's not only it's kitty litter, but they don't sell directly. So they don't have a bunch of email addresses of their consumers. So there's definitely tips and tricks to get customers to engage on that. And so you'd be surprised that if you put the right effort forward and work with the right folks to identify the ways to collect that content, it can be done on a very broad range of products and industries.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, that's a fantastic point. I think that, you know, I work with some B2B industries that you would think are incredibly boring, and they wouldn't have anything to say. But I think you've got to step out and look outside of your product set. And that's the first rule of content marketing is that it's not about us. If you're going to create real social sharing and social conversations, if you've got amazing products like Apple, that's fantastic. The community does the marketing for you. But in a lot of cases, you don't have products that people want to talk about. So you have to focus on, really look hard at what the pain points are of your customers, because in that realm, so if you're talking about financial or checking accounts, you know, you can talk about things like security, very, very important. I mean, why would somebody get a checking account today in the first place? Frankly, that question should be answered. If you're not talking about a checking, I mean, I would want to know, if I'm going to get a checking account, why do I need one? What are the alternatives to that? What are some best practices? You know, those types of things. And if you just think about it simply as starting with looking at your customer questions, I mean, go to customer service, go to sales. They probably have an editorial calendar for you that will be hard for you to maintain, because there's so many customer questions out there that you can answer. And by the way, if you don't answer them, probably somebody else will. And I think the best way to think about it is, think of yourself as like the leading trade magazine in your industry. And what would you be talking about if you were a media company and not necessarily just, you know, trying to sell products or services or checking accounts or whatever the case is? So just think about it a little bit differently. There's so much content. You have so many content assets. You know, Scott was talking about a number of really good examples. You have a lot of the assets already. You just have to take them and put them into story form, which a lot of people just don't do.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Great answers. Let's talk a little bit about negative reviews, because that seems to be a hot topic in general and among our listeners here. Let's just, if you don't mind, Scott, just going back to your example about the flashlight with Cabela's, do you know by any chance if, for that particular example, did Cabela's compensate or replace the customer's dysfunctional products for the customer who gave negative reviews?
Yeah, I don't know in that particular example, but I know that does happen from time to time, and it really depends on what your policy is and how much that cost is. But when you look at the value of a company, go ahead and, like, reaching out and correcting that wrong with consumers, it's usually a very high ROI, because the cost to obtain a new customer is so much higher. So if you can retain those customers, it's a very valuable thing. And then to speak a little about the negative content,
yeah,
you know, for the Cabela's flashlight, once they created a new flashlight in that example, then we'd recommend that they actually create a brand new SKU and collect new content on that new flashlight, because that old content is no longer valid or relevant. So they can go ahead and create a much higher rated product, because the new product is a brand new product. So they could collect new content on that product and drive that rating a lot higher. And the other thing that people think about with a negative content is, if I put that on my website, people are going to know about this negative content. Well, the reality is, we know that customers, when they're, like, searching and shopping, they go to, like, 10.4 different sources before making a buying decision. So they're finding that content somewhere out on the web. And if you don't provide information about your products and services on your website, you're risking them leaving your website and going elsewhere to find that content and risking that sale altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that we do with our customers is just, like, there people are out there, they're finding this information, and we can show them examples of where people are talking about those products. So just making that real to them. And then the second thing is, a lot of times our customers, when they launch, they might collect content for 6 months to understand what's going on with their products or services before they ever put that live on their website. So they'll collect the content, try to make some changes within their organization to improve that product or service that they're selling, and then go live and show the broad world what those ratings are on their website.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a good example, some good examples there. But, I mean, in general, though, what should listeners do if they have, you know, like, for instance, they have a lot of user-generated content that's negative? I mean, are there any best practices around that, how that should be handled?
Well, I mean, I would say that the JetBlue example, I mean, I forgot the guy's name. What was the JetBlue flight attendant that said, basically left the plane, and it was this big catastrophe. I think we can learn a lot from what JetBlue does. First of all, they have a plan for this, so they were prepared for that kind of a thing, unbelievably. But I think where most of us think that if somebody has a negative review, let's say on Twitter, or negative comments on Twitter or Facebook, that we're relegated for them to basically put that on our Facebook page and Twitter site. And really, we don't have to, and if we can look at JetBlue, where you can take a little bit of control over that. You can't control the conversation, but you can control where that conversation happens to a certain extent. So what I love about what JetBlue did is they said, look, because they were getting all these comments on Facebook and everything on Twitter, and they said, look, we want to have this conversation, and we want to hear your feedback, but we'd like to have it over here. And they had a blog post that they responded to it, and they said, please, let me, and they had tons of feedback. But what you saw that had happened when they said, look, we want to welcome the conversation, but we'd like to have it over here on our blog where we can control it, that was that really got the comments really ended on Facebook, and they ended on Twitter, and everybody started to have that conversation on the blog. So I think a lot of people feel, oh, well, what can I do about the negative Facebook comments? Well, you don't have to have those comments there. Make sure that you're very proactive in your response, but let the person know, let the community know where the conversation is going to happen, and I think you can control that a little bit.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Okay, this I thought this was kind of an interesting question. Getting back to user-generated content in marketing materials, how do you go about doing that if you don't have the user's permission, like ratings and quotes? Do you have to have the permission, or what's the like legalese around that?
I'd leave that to Scott. Scott, you got to take on that?
Yeah, well, that's going to be up to your individual lawyer, but it usually depends on the T's and C's of the website. Usually that is the overarching thing that dictates what you can go do with that content. But really those rules, when somebody submits on any of your digital domains, it's really up to you to identify what those T's and C's are, but a lot of times it's really whatever you want it to be. And typically you have pretty broad use of that content. Most of our clients, actually, they own the content, have the right to reproduce that, republish it, all of those different things. And so you're definitely pretty covered on that typically, but again, that's up to each specific website and what kind of T's and C's you want to put in place.
And I would just say if you want more detail on that, because we've looked at fair use quite a bit, if you look at the kind of content you're trying to take off of different sites and use in blog posts and whatnot, if you just type in fair use content curation, fair use content curation into Google, there's a couple stories right up top that I think would help you take the next step when it comes to what the fair usage is, because obviously Google's done a number of research studies into this area as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's see, I hope that answers the question. We have a listener who is a photographer, and he's currently using social media to advertise his photos. I guess this could go to Joe. What type of content should he be looking at aside from the images for creating buzz or to create an interaction with the blog and the website?
Well, I mean, there's no silver bullet with any of this. You can be successful in multiple ways. I think the first thing is just to step back and figure out who are you actually targeting. The biggest problem that we see, and we work with a lot of Fortune 1000 companies, and you'd be surprised at the focus on what companies want to say rather than looking at who the customers are and what they really need to hear. And that's a big, big difference. So the first thing I would say is, who are you targeting? Do you have a buyer persona for that person that you're trying to reach? What are those pain points? What do they do every day? What do they want to do for their next step? I mean, be very specific with that buyer persona. And then once you understand that, then you can really put together a list of, you know, what does this person need to hear that ultimately, I mean, this is not just content for content's sake. This is marketing at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, you have a marketing objective that you're trying to solve. What is that? How are you going to measure that? And then you can figure out in between, what are you going to talk about? What channels that you are going to try to create? I would probably say number one step, and there's obviously I wrote a book on this. There's a whole content strategy. There's seven steps that you got to go through. But the number one thing is, what is your content mission? What is the thing that you really want your customers to learn or take away? If you have that mission statement, just like an editorial mission statement that most publications have, if you look at that, then you understand what stories would be relevant under that mission. And most companies, frankly, do not have that mission. They're creating lots of content in lots of different places, but they don't really have an overall strategy for why they're doing that. So I would say take a step back, figure out the who, and then understand the real why to why you're creating that content for them.
Okay, great. Let's see, we have a couple more questions. This also could go to Joe. Once you get your story together and you have all your content, how do you suggest publishing it and getting it out to potential customers? What are some best practices there? Are there particular mediums that you should use?
Wow. where to start on that one? I really believe in the idea of a platform. and I have been talking about this for a while, and there's a lot of really good, really smart people that talk about the idea of creating a platform. Because if you look at what the leading media companies today, if you're looking at Huffington Post or New York Times or Journal or whatever, they all have started with a platform. So where's the most of that content coming from? And for the most part, most brands today are creating some form of a blog, offshoot to the website, a blog that can enter, whether that's a WordPress blog or whatever technology you use to publish your content. You can integrate video, slides, ebooks, white papers, research reports, whatever your content is, into that platform. And then from there, you can look at your distribution outlets, whether that's for B2B, something like a SlideShare is fantastic for ebooks, whether you're looking at basically, you know, the big five social media sites, whatever the case is from a content distribution standpoint. But again, I would say please make sure that you look at what that buyer persona is before you get into any further with on the publishing schedule. And I would really also look at the difference between bricks and feathers. Most companies that we work with have lots of feathers, lots of blog posts, lots of fleeting content. Do you have research like ebooks and white papers that's really going to make a significant difference, and then use those feathers, those blog posts, to lead into that content on an ongoing basis?
Okay. Just quickly, what's the name of the book that you wrote?
Oh, it's called Managing. The most recent one is Managing Content Marketing with Robert Rose.
Okay, great. All right. How about this? We have a specific question from a listener. The listener publishes trade magazines for the forest products industry, and the listener's magazines are ad-supported and free to qualified subscribers. So what is the best way, Joe, in your opinion, to use social data to increase both ad sales and reader satisfaction?
Well, I would throw that to Scott first, just on the – so, Scott, I don't have
social
an
data.
Opinion on the – since he's talking.
Yeah.
Scott's a social data expert, so let's throw that to Scott.
You know, one of the things that we've seen successful – it's not quite the same parallel, but if you think about people who are really into cooking and baking, throwing up an idea of, like, submit your ideas on a great recipe or some of your favorite things to go cook, that could be a little bit of a parallel. I know it's a little bit of a stretch, but you think about forest products and outdoor power equipment industries, the people in those industries have their own tips and tricks of what they do and how they're effective at doing their job, and creating sort of a dialogue or a forum online to let those people interact and provide their tips, their tricks. You could take a curated sample of those and put them into your magazine, and then that'll help drive people back to the website. So I think some of those things are probably things that would resonate well with that crowd. But you know, it's really about who that crowd is, what they'd like to know, and what kind of conversations are they having with colleagues on a day-to-day basis, and try to digitize those and make them you know, expanded to other readers.
And then just to follow that up, great point, Scott. I mean, what we do, and it's we have the same issue with the person asking the question because we act a lot like a media company. So we've got to make sure that we listen from both the ad sales side and the reader side. And we follow Twitter like a hawk. And we've got two people that do that. We look at different hashtags, different keywords. We follow particular people. We have an influencer list of people that we follow on a consistent basis that we share content from, as well as as well as everything else that we're doing. So I would say make sure that you have social media listening in place specifically for where your customers are hanging out. For us, it happens to be Twitter. It could be LinkedIn groups. That could be on Facebook, but for us, it's Twitter and LinkedIn.
Okay, great. Let's see. We have time for about one more question. I'm not exactly sure what this question is asking, but and it goes to Scott. Let's see. What about the fact that, you know, these folks may already have the information that you're asking in terms of user-generated information? What happens if somebody's already polling and asking for feedback from their customers? What does social data offer that's different?
I guess a couple things. When you look at if you're already surveying your customers, that's a really interesting form of social data. But when you ask people to submit content to help out other consumers, you get a different segment of the population that responds to that. So you're getting a broader swath of the population when they provide those responses. And then secondarily, you're probably getting people in a really different kind of frame of mind. A lot of times you're getting people that are maybe reaching out to your customer service group to complain about something. When you ask people just to, hey, tell me about this product or service, you're just getting more of that average of the bell curve of people responding and telling you what's important. So, you know, thinking about where they are in that journey, what their frame of mind is, making it social has different reasons why people contribute. And because of that, you can get a much broader swath of your population and much more targeted information.
Great. Did you want to add anything to that, Joe? Or?
No, I think that was well said. I think it's a good place to end.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think it's probably time to wrap it up. We have about, we basically have to wrap it up. And I just want everybody, the few folks that didn't get their questions answered, I'm sure our listeners, I mean, our speakers would be really happy to answer the questions offline. Is that correct? There's a couple of questions left here. So anyway, with that, I'd like to thank Joe Polizzi and Scott Custer, as well as our vendor, Bizarre Voice, our sponsor. And thanks a lot for listening today, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.